Why don't we start with the discussion, because I think it's also educational, about the next step in the information that you provided yesterday, which appeared in the paper this morning. Tell us a little bit about the research and your next step. As I understand it, while you've been able to identify a group of individuals that is carrying a gene with a specific mutation, and therefore you can say, I guess in general terms, that you believe that those people are at a higher risk of breast cancer, but you can't really yet to say how significant that is. And so is the next step, in essence, to make a determination about what that probability may be?
And so that's right. And that's what we are beginning, and beginning soon. Let me just comment two things about that. This will be the first time that we will be diagnosing a abnormality in a cancer predisposition gene in individuals that have not already come to medical attention because they belong to a known high-risk family. And that gives an entirely new set of challenges and opportunities to answer those questions. What risk do they actually have? For what sort of cancers? Is the risk shared by both men and women that carry this mutation? And what is the level of the risk as a function of their age? And the way we're going to be doing that is by a number of studies, including what we're calling this snapshot study in the metropolitan area Jewish community. I think one of the most extraordinary important things about this study is, in fact, not what the study is going to show us, but that as soon as this discovery was made in Dr. Collins' lab, we got together with breast cancer advocates, patient advocates, with representatives of the Jewish community, the national and the local Jewish community, to together design how we're going to answer these essential questions. These are the questions that we need to have answers to before we can say why an individual should want to have this test. Because for an individual to want to have a test, we need to know what we would say to that individual. Does it increase their risk, and how much, and for what? So we will be doing that. We will initiate the study within weeks, and we will hope to have this, quote, snapshot study done by next April, March or April. This is not going to take years. We will have this information within months.
What happens next? I mean, you're going to, I guess, in a sense, I'm kind of asking you to anticipate, I guess, what you might find, or ask you to assume certain things and say, well, here's what we're going to do now that we have that information.
Yes, I think most of us do suspect that this misspelling will carry an increased risk. So at the same time, what we are doing is expanding a whole number of studies the NIH is already funding, including the Counseling Cancer Genetic Susceptibility Counseling Consortium that Francis mentioned. We will be expanding that so that more patients, more individuals, more participants will have access to counseling and testing. We need to establish, and will be establishing at many sites throughout the country, a whole variety of studies to begin to answer the next questions, which is, if you are at an increased risk, what is the benefit of enhanced screening? Enhanced screening by mammography or tests for ovarian cancer. It's going to depend on what cancer emerges as individuals having the risk of getting. We need to do studies to let us know what's the optimum therapy for individuals with this particular mutation that get cancer and particular cancers. And this will all be done in the context of clinical research, which is how we have to do it. It's the only way we'll get the answers. And all of these studies will be incorporated with genetic counseling, counseling for individuals that test positive and counseling for individuals that test negative, because those individuals need counseling as well. That's a very important issue. For the breast cancer susceptibility gene, if you're in test negative for this mutation, you do not want individuals to think they are therefore not at risk for breast cancer. They are at risk for breast cancer. They're at the risk that all women are for breast cancer, lifetime risk of 1 in 8. And that's why counseling is so important. It's to prevent this information from, as Francis says, from being toxic. Our goal is to make sure this information helps patients.
Dr. Klausner, I want to go back, if I could, to the announcement made yesterday, because there are many aspects of it that are puzzling to me. You're saying that a woman's whose family's origins stem from Eastern Europe have a higher risk of breast cancer.
No.
Well, does this... You're
actually,
not.
We're not saying that.
Thank you.
We are not saying that. There have been numerous studies, actually, to ask the question whether in that population there's an increased risk of breast cancer, and the studies are somewhat confusing. We don't
what
really
are you
know
saying?
The data. What we are saying is that these individuals as a population have an increase in the frequency of finding a specific mutation in the BRCA1 gene. Now, let me explain. We're saying this incidence is 1%. That is high with respect to our calculated incidence in all populations of any specific or a BRCA1 mutation. It's perhaps 5 times higher, but it's still only 1%. Let me just give you a feeling for that. If those women, that 1%, had 100% risk of developing breast cancer, and we do not know that, it would increase the general risk of the Jewish Ashkenazi population of developing breast cancer by only 10%. Now, that's a lot for those individuals, but it would not show up as an enormous increase.
All right, that's important to know. Now, does this mean your grandparents came from there, your great-grandparents? I mean, how do you know?
Yes. Well, the country of origin, say, for American Ashkenazi Jews, generally is from their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents. And generally, we find by discussions with that community that most individuals can trace and identify their origins. They may not know the exact country. In fact, usually they more know the town rather than the country. But can identify whether it is from Central or Eastern Europe as opposed to North Africa,
for example. Would this be both parents? Both grandparents or both great-grandparents?
That's a good question. I think the gene would be carried through any single ancestor, and so we would want to know whether any of their ancestors came to this country.
So it's carried by man and woman.
That's right, and that's very important. While we're talking about this as a breast cancer susceptibility, breast and ovarian cancer susceptibility gene, it is equally carried by men and women. And in fact, we need to find out whether the men that carry this gene are at an increased risk for cancer. There is some evidence in high cancer risk families that have BRCA1 mutations that men are at somewhat of an increased risk for prostate cancer.
Now, does it skip a generation, or is it every generation?
It could appear to skip a generation. If, for instance, you have it passed from grandmother to her son, and men often don't show signs of it, and then he passes it to his daughter, you could see a daughter having breast cancer and the grandmother having had breast cancer, and it would look as if it skipped a generation. But the gene didn't skip a generation. It was there. It just didn't show itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were one of these women who picked up this morning's Washington Post, what should she do?
Well,
or man, for that matter.
That's right. Well, as we have tried to provide as information, the National Cancer Institute has an enormous number of resources for information for individuals to call. There's a toll-free number throughout the country. It's 1-800-4-CANCER. This is the Cancer Information Service. We take over 600,000 calls a year. And anyone can call this and find out information about what's known about this and what's not known, about where studies are taking place, about where testing will become available. And so this information is being disseminated throughout the community. And again, we are working with the Jewish community specifically to make sure that this information is present in publications read by the Jewish community. And other ways of communicating specifically with that community.
Do clinical practitioners know about this?
Yes, as well, the information that we've sent out is available for healthcare providers. Again, there are several well-known and highly used information resources that the National Cancer Institute has had and has set up for all healthcare providers to provide up-to-date information about all aspects of cancer.
Now, Kind of interesting. Apparently, there's a Time CNN poll last year which found that the American public was really ambivalent on this question, as you've said. And when people were asked whether they would take a genetic test that could tell them what diseases they were likely to suffer later in life, 49% said they would prefer not to know. That's and right. 50% said they would want to know. Can you comment on that?
I know this poll very well. The problem may partly have been the question was not posed in a way that the person answering it could tell whether having that information would be useful to them or not. Is this a prediction about, well, you're going to get Alzheimer's disease, but sorry, there's nothing we can do about it?
Right.
Or is it, you might be getting colon cancer, you should be in a screening program to pick up that polyp while it's still easily treated? Other polls that I think have been better done would indicate that the answer depends critically upon what kind of test you're talking about. The majority of people, if asked about something where some treatment is available or some way of reducing their risk, say, yeah, I'd probably like to hear about that and I probably would be interested. Whereas the minority would say, if there's nothing you can do, but they're not so interested.
Now, what most of us go into our doctors for our annual checkup. Genetic screening is not a part of this.
No.
I've never been genetically screened.
Well, you've had your cholesterol checked, I would bet. And in a way, when people have their cholesterol checked, that is a sort of form of genetic screening. The thing that sort of determines your set point, to a large extent, is your genes. Your diet can move it up and down, but there's certainly a genetic contribution to that. So in that sense, maybe genetic testing is not as out there as people assume it is.
Do you think it should be done? Is there a recommendation that people should be tested genetically or not?
I think there are essentially no genetic tests that are currently appropriate to be offered in somebody who has no family history of a particular condition, no tests that are appropriate for screening. I think those are the issues that this genetic testing task force is going to try to come up with. Specific guidelines. When is a test ready for that point? The one that maybe looms the closest would be the possibility of testing the Jewish population for this BRCA1 gene, but we're not there yet. Again, we wouldn't know quite what to tell those people who turn out to be positive about what that means, nor would we know what to tell them exactly about what they should do. And we have to have better answers to that, I think, before people are going to be particularly grateful for this information. Why is cholesterol testing acceptable? It's because we have pretty good information that that's a risk factor and that there are things you can do about it with diet or drug therapy that will reduce your risk of having a heart attack. We're not quite there yet with genetic testing.
And even that's very confusing because your good has to be, if your good is better than your bad cholesterol. See, mine is high, but my good is high, so I forget all about it. Now,
well, genetic testing is going to be every bit as complicated. That's one of the things that really puts the burden upon all of us to get this information to physicians in ways that they can explain. Because many genetic tests are not going to be yes, no, all or nothing. They're going to be, your risk is about threefold higher than the average. Well, what does that mean? And what should I do about that? They're going to be statistical statements, just like cholesterol.
Get one last quick question. Of all grants submitted to the National Institutes of Health, about 25% are funded. Last year, Congress appropriated about $11.3 billion. What is an appropriate funding level to be able to carry out this and other major projects?
Let me just say that last year for the National Cancer Institute, our success rate.
This is a leading question for you.
I actually picked that up. Our success rate was less than 20% for grants. Well, I don't know exactly the answer to what the appropriate funding level is. I think what you're witnessing here is the extraordinary success of the National Institutes of Health that you have supported and funded. Our success breeds new opportunities to positively affect health. We need to find resources to fund those new opportunities. When I went through the list of what we're going to have to develop in terms of infrastructure, of cancer genetics clinics, of new training programs, of databases and family registries, all of these are important opportunities. They're opportunities that we created by the discoveries we're talking about. we can stop doing all the other incredibly important things I think we're doing in terms of looking for new therapies and diagnostics, but our success is going to put more demands on the system if we're going to respond to them.
I just might make a comment with respect to that last question. Roughly 19-20% approval rate NCI, but that's of 100% that was screened through peer review. In other words, there was a lot of other data that was rejected. In other words, fine-tuned, and then that fine-tuned group was reduced down to roughly 20%. Is that?
That less than 20% funding are not funding all the grants that the scientific community thinks absolutely should be funded by merit. That's as high as we can get because of the resources available. I mean,
what you're saying is that the, what you're saying is yeah that what they review, the 100% that they review, they're saying that passes muster, being really grants that should be funded.
And only 20%.
And only 20% of those get funded.
Right. Yes. So, I mean, there is no question that grants that are unanimously considered absolutely outstanding are not getting funded.
Well, same is true for the National Center for Human Genome Research. Certainly our pay line is at about the 19th percentile, I think, even though this is a field that everybody agrees is going to pay for itself many times over. We did a little analysis of the economic benefits that are likely to occur when testing for colon cancer susceptibility gets all the bugs worked out. And it does look as if it is considerably cheaper to find out who the people are at high risk and get them into screening programs than treat a lot of people with far advanced colon cancer. So I think there's a temptation to say new technology is always going to cost more money. That's often true for sort of the intermediate stages, but in the more well-developed stages, I think you will see healthcare costs coming down as a consequence of all this. And by delaying the research, you also delay enjoying those benefits.
Well, again, we appreciate the time that you've spent with us and the information that you've shared with us this morning. We could keep this going for quite some time, but we do have a third panel, and it's getting close to noon. So thank you very much for participating with us
this
morning.
Thank you.